Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
As always, just want to thank our subscribers who are listening on Tuesday as you are helping to keep this thing afloat. A quick programming update, particularly for those folks. I am headed out of the country next week, which means, or like this week, and by the time not quite by the time you listen to this, but I'm headed out of the country, which means we will probably tape next week on Tuesday, which is when this usually goes up, which means the earliest that subscribers will be able to get it is probably Wednesday, maybe Tuesday night. We'll see what the taping schedules look like. But I would guess probably Wednesday. So I apologize in advance, you know, after all these thank yous on Tuesday, whatever. It's going to, you know, of course, that means we'll have to push the freeloaders back a day as well. And the, you know, et cetera. You should just avoid all this by subscribing and you'll get it as soon as possible. You won't have to worry about it. So just go sign up at movieaisle.substack.com. Appreciate it. And we will now move on to controversies and non-troversies. Fans of the opera and ballet found themselves in a tizzy this week. They were doing pliés and whatnot all over the place. Monocles were popping out of eyes, etc. As video emerged of Timothy Chalamet in conversation with Matthew McConaughey, he said the following during a CNN town hall, quote, "I admire people, and I've done it myself, who can go on a talk show and go, hey, we got to keep movie theaters alive. You know, we got to keep this genre alive. And another part of me feels like if people want to see it, like Barbie, like Oppenheimer, they're going to go see it and go out of their way and be loud and proud about it. And I don't want to be working in ballet or opera or things where it's like, hey, keep this thing alive, even though it's like no one cares about this anymore. And people laughed a little bit and he laughed and he said, all respect to the ballet and opera people out there. I just lost 14 cents in viewership," end quote. Now, needless to say, the dozens of opera fans and ballet fans in the country were outraged by this. Here were a few choice reactions. American opera singer Isabel Leonard also responded to the clip. She wrote in a comment about the Chalamet video, "Honestly, I'm shocked that someone so seemingly successful can be so ineloquent and narrow-minded in his views about art while considering himself as an artist, as I would only imagine one would as an actor." Canadian opera singer Deepa Jani said, he called it a disappointing take and then said, "There is nothing more impressive than the magic of live theater, ballet and opera. We should be trying to uplift these art forms, these artists, and come together across disciplines to do that." Irish opera singer Sean Tester posted on his Instagram to say that Chalamet's choice of words is the kind of reductive take you hear when popularity is mistaken for cultural value. They are not outdated art forms. They are living ones, constantly reinterpreted, constantly evolving. It's always fascinating when artists with global platforms dismiss opera and ballet as irrelevant. Opera and ballet have survived wars. To call these art forms irrelevant says far less about the art itself than it does about how little time someone has spent truly experiencing it," end quote. This all seems transparently silly. And a good faith reading of what Chalamet said is patently obvious. Opera and ballet were once relatively mainstream entertainments that dominated the culture and particularly higher echelons of the culture. And now they have been relegated to the margins of culture writ large, certainly, but elite society as well. And they have trouble staying afloat. This is a thing. This is a real problem. The ballet and opera are not hugely profitable endeavors. They take lots of, you know, fundraising, etc., to stay in business and to continue doing what they do. He doesn't want film to be like that. And there is a big debate about this right now. There's big debate about this, about, you know, the future of film. Is it going to be a niche project that there's going to be like 500 IMAX screens in the country and that's all anyone goes to see, and the tickets are $45 a piece, right? Like that's a real conversation that's going on right now. He doesn't want it. to be that way. Of course, good faith has no place on the internet or on podcasts, which means, Peter, we get to decide which part of Timothy Chalamet's body we get to claim after he is drawn and quartered for his horrible crimes against the incredibly popular art forms of ballet and opera, which are beloved by all. And nobody has ever said anything about them being unpopular before. Peter, I call his right arm.
I don't think he's going to be drawn and quartered. I mean, there might be AI videos, but I don't think he's going to be drawn. That seems excessive. Maybe. I don't know. Is this what your enemies do when, because I know you like to fire people into the sun. Do you just imagine that, like, the other people who are the non-sunnies of the world, when they get angry, their response is to draw and quarter people?
Or do opera and ballet fans specifically draw and quarter people because they're so old fashioned and out of date?
Yeah, I mean, I just assume that they're all from like Braveheart times. It's just gonna be fake, right?
They're just gonna use the red ribbons and it's just gonna be like, oh, we're just mocking it. It didn't really happen. You don't actually see what happens in Braveheart. Yeah, right.
This is silly.
So I was just doing, like, I did a very, very quick and cursory look into some of the stats, like some of the National Endowment for the Arts reports. And it is clear that even since like the mid 2010s, attendance and finances are down at basically every performing arts institution. This is a gloss, like that's not there might be like some exceptions to this, but that is broadly true across the category of performing arts. It's down even more since 2002, right? So this isn't just something that once was popular, dropped, and is now kind of at a steady state. It is still shrinking. And this is and everybody in that business, everybody who is in that art form knows it. Because I mean, something I was reading, I forget who said this, so I don't have the source in front of me, but something that was going around in response to this was, I'm in this world. And guess what? In ballet and opera, one of the things we do constantly is put on shows, the theme of which is save the ballet or save opera. I mean, these art forms, in addition to just sort of having general problems, it's not just that they're not popular with elites. They have really serious problems with younger attendees, viewers, whatever, you know, fans, whatever you want to call them, to the point where just kind of if you look at performing arts in any big city, there's live theater, even stuff that's a little more, that's like I'm going to say is a little more accessible. Somebody's going to get mad at me for saying that live theater is more accessible than ballet, but like it kind of is in certain ways. There are almost always, or I should say very frequently, I don't know if it's actually true that it's the majority of the time, but very frequently there are discounts for young people, with young people being defined in some cases as up to 45.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because people who are, and again, it's different by program and by city. I don't mean it's always up to 45. Sometimes the cutoff is lower than that. Right. But like, that is the audience. It is a very, very tiny fraction of the country who tends to be much older, relatively better off because the tickets for these things are quite expensive. And many of these programs are run as nonprofits, which is not necessarily a bad way to run a program. Doesn't make it illegitimate, but does mean that it is no longer functioning as a popular art form. And film is maybe going that direction. I mean, like, certainly it feels like it when you look at some of the box office numbers that we've seen just in the past couple of years. Last October was, I think I can get this right, the worst October, excluding the pandemic, for the box office in something like 30 years, since sometime in the 1990s, right? So it's not the worst month overall, but it is the worst October in about 30 years because there's not enough product in the theaters. And when people are putting product in the theaters, the people aren't going out to see them. And also because filmmakers are making stuff that is crazy and people don't want to go see. And we're going to talk about The Bride in a little bit.
Am I the only one of us who's gone to the opera more than once or like at all?
I have been more than once, but when I say more than once, I've been like twice. Literally
yeah.
Twice.
Yeah.
Once in Prague. It was nice. I went to the opera there. It was very, very, very sweet. But I think the opera house
sequence in Mission Impossible 5, I think it was.
I would guess you are probably the most cultured among us, Alyssa.
Yeah. I mean, my husband actually introduced me to the opera sort of when we started dating, and I wouldn't say it is an art form that I've become incredibly passionate about, but I have gone a fair amount. We went in Vienna. We're talking about trying to make it to La Scala in Milan in the next couple of years. And I feel like my experiences with opera have both have enriched my life. It's a beautiful form. But it also, it totally makes sense to me that it is not a popular, that it is not a genuinely popular or sort of populist art form right now, given just where American audiences are in general, right? I mean, much of it is not in English, which, you know, I think is a challenge. We see that as a challenge for foreign film as well. So you need people who are willing to, you know, sit through subtitled dialogue or frankly, just to, you know, listen to things that they don't actually understand and follow along with the emotion or who have the cultural literacy to understand what's going on in the first place. It's a form that asks quite a lot of the audience, not just in terms of money, but in terms of attention, sort of background knowledge, you know, willingness to kind of perform certain sorts of formality. Like it's a, you know, I think the opera is a place where there's still real sort of expectations for dress and comportment. And I think that it is, you know, look, it's too bad that a form that was originally sort of a popular form of art and then became more upscale has not found a way to kind of transmit itself to new generations. But the sort of the defensiveness on display here on, you know, by people in opera and ballet is unwise, both because it is sort of an embarrassing form of denial, but also because there could be a really interesting dialogue between people who are keeping these art forms alive and people in film who are supposed, who are trying to avoid a similar fate, right? And it's like, what do opera houses and ballet companies understand both about the people who left and the people who have continued to come? And, you know, what can studios, what can actors, what can directors, what can writers sort of learn from all of this about keeping their, you know, keeping their genre reinvigorated? I mean, I think one thing that is challenging for opera and for ballet is that when people do go see these forms, they generally prefer certain classics. It's hard to introduce new operas and ballets except to sort of a select audience. And so, you know, maybe there is something for the movies to learn about kind of getting stuck on the same old IP, right? And not sort of bringing people along to new kinds of stories, new ways of experiencing art, new ways of talking about art and being in conversation about it. And, you know, I think denying what is happening is stupid and embarrassing, but it's also, you know, there could be a real rich dialogue here that could be useful for multiple forms. And it's a shame that this has become a deeply silly conversation as a result.
I want to take it one step back away from the actual subject matter here, because the real thing that I find frustrating about this is we always talk about how interviews with celebrities are boring. Interviews are with, you know, they're always boring because everybody is so, you know, they're saying the same things. Nobody wants to, you know, cause a stir. Nobody wants to make a ruckus. And the reason for that is because even when somebody says something that is totally, like, you cannot possibly argue with the things he is saying. Like, they're just objectively true. The defensiveness, and then, like, everybody taking their turn yelling at him online and being like, oh, let's punish his Oscar chances for this. It drives me crazy. Because if you want interesting interviews with these people, you have to, like, not engage with whatever they say in the worst faith possible. And that is,
out of the interview. I think the people who want the interesting interviews, in fact, at least some of them, what they want is something that they can misinterpret maliciously, because that's fun.
But I
don't think it's fun.
But again, like, wanting to be mad about something like this, if you're an opera or ballet person or an opera ballet lover, is stupid just because everyone's rage addiction is stupid. But also, it mocks any pretension you have to being a more sophisticated and subtle consumer of information and media, right? Like, if you're supposed to be the people who are arguing for consuming art forms that are nuanced, that reward attention, that rewards sort of sitting with things that you don't necessarily immediately understand, acting like whiny babies on the internet makes you poor ambassadors for your form. And look, I spend a lot less time on the internet than I used to, on social media in particular, in part because I realized that being mad online all the time was bad for me. And that specifically that writing pieces, being outraged about things that people said in interviews, like, it was just not the way that I mostly wanted to engage with the world. And I don't know that there is an easy way to turn back that impulse, considering how much data we have about how well rage performs online and sort of how contagious it is. But I think especially if you are in an art form where you want people to slow down, if you want them not to be as addicted to the sort of quick negative hit of dopamine, you really have to think about checking that impulse.
Yeah.
It's also an own goal because it misses an opportunity to promote the form rather than to essentially whine about that it got that people are talking about it at all. Right.
Right.
Which is how this comes across. And if you like the correct thing to do here is to say, yeah, it's in decline. That's unfortunate. If you wish it wasn't, come out. We'll show you why it's great. We'll make the case for you. And they didn't do that. And the reason, and what does that tell you? That tells you to some degree or another why these forms are in decline, because they are absolutely refusing to meet people where they are and show the and make the case for their own form.
Yeah.
And look, Chalamet is out there saying, that's what we got to do for movies.
Yeah. And there is a reason that film often uses opera or ballet as a backdrop, right? Like, they are beautiful forms. They are transporting, right? I mean, you know, the concert scene that opens Tenet is really, you know, sort of sharp and interesting. And the contrast between the sort of transportation and sort of shared vulnerability of the audience and what is done to them is striking, right? I mean, there is the 1994 adaptation of Little Women, and again, this is somewhat old, has this wonderful scene where Gabriel Byrne's character takes Winona Ryder to the opera and is translating the German for her, right? And it's this sort of incredible act of kind of intimacy and understanding. There's a reason that you do it at Mission Impossible, right? I mean, the movies themselves recognize the value of these art forms and in their own way often promote their power. And so again, it's a total missed opportunity for promotion and dialogue, instead of for the cheapest, dumbest, most anti-opera and ballet thing possible.
The smartest response was the Seattle opera company, which offered a discount if you used the code Timothy for their performance of Carmen starting this. So I, you know, that's you just offer promo codes. That's smart. That's how you get people in the door. All right. What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Timothy Chalamet dared suggest opera and ballet are not hugely popular cultural activities anymore? Peter.
I mean, it's an online dust up, and in some sense that means it's a controversy by definition, but no, it shouldn't be controversial. It's literally the case that it is a declining form.
Alyssa.
It's a non-controversy, but for his penance, Chalamet should have to do like an incredible method dressing savvy press tour where he like goes on Chicken Shop Date and like Subway Takes and promotes opera for 6 months.
It's a non-controversy, people should stop being so annoying online. That's my evergreen take. All right, make sure to swing by movieisle.substack.com on Thursday for our bonus episode on big swing movies, right? Sometimes big swing, you know, if you're a baseball player, you know, you're taking a big swing, you're going to miss 8 times out of 10. You're probably going to miss 9 times out of 10. If you're swinging for the fences, that's a tough one. You don't always do that. You usually whiff. And that is the case with a lot of big swing movies. You know, they don't always work. When they do work, they can be magical. They even when they don't work, right? That's more fun than boring competence, at least in my humble opinion. Anyway, speaking of a big swing movie that didn't work.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On to the main event. The Bride. Okay. Sometimes, again, you see a movie described as a big swing or interesting, right? Critics love doing this. Critics, we love doing this. We love saying, "You're this." They took a big swing here. This movie's really interesting because critics see lots of movies that are bad. They see even more movies that are boring. So seeing a movie that's bad but not boring is a real treat. It's a real treat. Even, you know, even like I would sometimes rather see like a excitingly bad movie than a boringly competent one. Anyway, we don't know how to handle this. Critics, we have no idea what to do with this. So we slap the word interesting on it and we move on. I mean, it's very important for our purposes here to distinguish between interesting and good, because interesting movies can be good, but they are not necessarily good. And I am here to tell you that The Bride is interesting and bad. Interesting, yes. It's bad. Bad movie. The badness starts right at the top, right at the beginning, with this completely inscrutable framing device in which we see Mary Shelley, who's played by Jesse Buckley, introducing the story that we're about to watch and suggesting that she always resented Frankenstein. She wanted to write something else. You know, there she wrote an original version of this, and they were like, you can't write something so feminist, Mary Shelley, you have to write a different book. And so she wrote it, and it was enormously successful. But, you know, that's not what she was into. So this thing we are led to believe is what she wanted to write, The Bride. Sure. To do this, she invades the mind of a 1930s Chicago mole, Ida, who was also played by Buckley, and then proceeds to have a spastic fit and get tossed out of a nightclub and then thrown down the stairs and dies. She breaks her neck. She dies. Luckily for her, Frankenstein's monster, played by Christian Bale, is in town trying to find a doctor who will make him a mate. This doctor, who's played by Annette Bening, agrees to do this mostly to see if she can. Just the challenge. They go out looking for a corpse, only to find, you guessed it, Ida. They bring her back to life. Right from the get-go, she has a mind of her own. She's not going to be told what to do by anyone. She says she'd rather not do things. What's the line, Peter, from Bartleby the Scrivener?
I'd prefer not to.
Which is repeated.
She says repeatedly.
She says this over and over again. We'll get to this. That's like opera.
It's like,
man. It's cultural.
I'll
I'm not
be
dealing
back
with that.
For Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's her catchphrase.
We'll be back to that. We'll be back to this amazing catchphrase for her. Anyway, none of this really makes any sense at all, even within the context of the film itself. Like, either Mary Shelley is real and Frankenstein is fictional, or Frankenstein is fictional and Mary Shelley is real. But to have both of these things true at the same time is deeply confusing. I'm sorry. It's just a very confused thing that is going on here. I don't want to get too hung up on this because there's all sorts of magical realism stuff happening in this movie that maybe we can talk about. Like, the power of the movies, for instance, but we can discuss all that in a minute. We could do probably 15 minutes on Maggie Gyllenhaal's relationship with Jake Gyllenhaal too, just the way that he comes across. Anyway, long story short, Frank and the bride have to go all Bonnie and Clyde after Frank kills a pair of jerks who try to rape the bride at the worst nightclub in the history of the universe. Is a nightmare of cross-dressing goths and new wave kids that's in a cabaret that seems to have been transported from Weimar Germany to 1930 Chicago.
Is it worse than the Matrix, like, rave orgy?
This is a million times worse than any of the nightclubs in the Matrix. I feel like the last time we talked about this, I revealed that I did not realize in the first Matrix that was like a bondage club that Neo goes to in the opening moments. That movie series is full of, at the very least, thematically resonant parties and raves, right? Like the cave orgy is at least like, hey, they're all getting in touch with their humanity. They're having a cave orgy. Okay, fine. And then they go to like the bondage club in the third movie, which is like very machine-like. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. All of those bars are a million times better than this terrible bar. Anyway, there is also, for some reason, about halfway through the movie, we get introduced to this bizarre subplot with Peter Sarsgaard, who's a detective who has sins to atone for, and we have absolutely no reason to care about any of this. This must have been a rewrite, because it just drops into the movie from nowhere. Anyway, again, movie's bad. It's rarely boring. I'll say I was rarely bored. Buckley commits furiously to the terrible bit she's doing. She's all tics and jerks and terrible accents. Oddly enough, for a film that's supposed to be a feminist retelling of The Bride of Frankenstein, the character that the film best has a handle on is Frankenstein himself, Christian Bale. He's played as an incel, but like kind of a polite one. He's worried about inconveniencing everybody else. He escapes into the movies. He spends a lot of his time desperately trying to contain the rage inside of him. Honestly, it's like it's an incredibly empathetic and like weirdly consistent portrayal in a movie that is not filled with very good, consistent portrayals. Bale's performance is not subtle exactly, but it's more restrained and therefore more successful than Buckley's. The whole thing feels like it's something somebody came up with in 2018. It's a lot like the Blink Twice, which we reviewed last year. I think that came out maybe the year before. It just feels like a throwback to a previous era. And I don't mean the 1930s when it's set. I mean like 2018. Nobody has quite cracked how to make this compelling on screen. I'll put it that way. Indeed.
Yeah, it feels like a time capsule from before the vibe shift.
That's
a throwback
to
sort of.
That's one. Certainly one way to put it. Look, I'll say the thing about this movie is that if it wasn't so aggressive in its feminist messaging, I would argue that there's a different, actually much more interesting and frankly thematically consistent interpretation here, which is that this is functionally a film about the horrors of schizophrenia. Like, think about it, right? Ida is a woman who in her mid-20s starts hearing voices and seeing things. Her delusions drive her to act in unusual ways. Erratically, she puts herself in danger. She commits acts of violence. By refusing treatment, she winds up living on the streets with another deranged homeless person. If this is not like a textbook case of schizophrenia, I don't know what is. Alyssa, is this secretly a mental health masterpiece? Is this a mental health pay on to getting treatment for your problems?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But I also don't think this movie knows what it is. It's a very confused movie. And there were sort of two things that I found it especially odd that the film did not really grapple with. And one of them is that it's shockingly incurious about women and their bodies and their relationships to them, right? Because like Ida is literally, you know, she is a body who's sort of put in harm's way by a cop who has recruited her. And then she's literally just like a body who is dug up and is, you know, she's not chosen because of any quality. Like she's just chosen because she's dead. She's a convenient piece of meat. And the movie has no real interest in how she feels about her body once it's reanimated. It doesn't have anything to say about the way she experiences pain. Like her, you know, her leg has been broken and is sort of put together with a brace. You know, her reincarnated self is like kind of hypersexual, but, you know, all sort of also strangely detached from sex in some ways. And so for a movie about a body that acquires a mind, it's strikingly sort of disembodied. And a lot of that insight is displaced onto Frank, who is a, you know, 100-something-year-old virgin who is constantly worried about his body's appearance, odors, secretions. Like, in a way, he is the much more feminized character, in the sense that he has sort of body anxiety in a way that the bride doesn't. And the movie has nothing really to say about the way that women's bodies are used, traded, exchanged, treated as currency. And the movie also has nothing to say really about what it would be like to totally start fresh on your life without inhibitions or without a feeling of constraint, right? Because one of the more interesting through lines is that Frank and the doctor kind of lie to Ida and say that she and Frank were together before, you know, there was an accident. And Frank kind of weaves this backstory about like how he proposed to her at Niagara Falls and they had oysters and champagne. And it sort of, you know, stirs loose for Ida that something's not quite right here, because we see that she really did not like oysters when she was alive. But there's no sense of like, what would a woman do or be if she could totally slip loose from the constraints of socialization, of sexism? There's this incredibly flip interregnum where, you know, a bunch of women basically start following the bride the way like people get into the Joker in various Batman movies. But it's totally underdeveloped. And, you know, it's like that really disappointed me, because in the aesthetics, in the way the bride and Frank are treated, and in their dynamic, and specifically in the way the bride is kind of costumed, the pair, yes, Bonnie and Clyde is sort of obviously the reference. But so it struck me were Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. The bride has like, right. You know, I mean, Courtney Love literally wore like 30s tea dresses on stage. She had this sort of mop of uncontrolled, you know, dyed platinum blonde hair. There was this sense, I mean, she was accused of, you know, like introducing Cobain to heroin, like murdering him. You know, she was sort of seen as the like kind of out of control figure in that relationship in some ways. And, you know, my cousin is visiting this weekend, and she was the person who introduced me to Nirvana and to Hole. And I still, you know, I think Celebrity Skin is an amazing album. If you've never listened to it, highly recommended. Same with Miss World. And it would be so interesting to make a movie about the Bride of Frankenstein as Courtney Love, right? And about sort of the Riot Girl scene and how transgressive it was in the late 80s and early 90s, right? I mean, and how embodied it was, and like physical and messy. And the movie just has none of that insight or energy at all, in part because it's so tied up in like 15 different framing devices, right? And I think there's a version of this that could have been like 90 minutes long and really rich and weird and interesting. But nothing in it fits together, and it has none of the ideas that Gyllenhaal wants it to express. And I think so much of that is related. It's a movie that is crude but disembodied, in a way that makes it end up feeling just astonishingly empty.
One thing that you mentioned that I think is interesting and bears into something we were chatting about a little before the show over text. You know, Frank Christian Bale Frankenstein's monster is kind of interestingly feminized in the sense of like he has a lot of body consciousness image, at least in terms of how, you know, women are often portrayed on screen. He has a lot of body images, right? He's like super into celebrity gossip, right? Like he carries around like a clipping of this movie star who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal in the film, and is like obsessed with him and gets like all flustered when he sees him at a party, like totally fawning over him. It as you were talking about that, it made, and like he is, I think he is, I think we would, we all agree he's like actually the best character in the film, at least in terms of like how he is realized, and like he feels like,
yeah,
he's a fuller great, character,
great emo Frankenstein,
yeah,
emo incel Frankenstein. But that also it called to mind the fact that I think you could make the case that Ken in the Barbie movie is like the, if not deeper character, kind of more interesting, goes over a larger journey. Like he is in a similar way, he is kind of placed into the role of very explicitly in the Barbie film. Like he is the woman of Barbie world, right? He is oppressed. He can't, there's no Kens on the Supreme Court of Barbie land. There's no, you know, they can't own property, et cetera. And like the movie is kind of most interesting when it's trying to figure out what to do with him. And it's just very weird that in both of these like super feminist films, they create a male character who is basically the woman of the story and is also the best character in the film. Am I reaching here? Is that incorrect?
No, you're not reaching at all. Barbie was obviously on the minds of the development executives who worked on this. Now, it's hard to say what else was on their minds because nothing in this movie makes any sense. And this is actually this movie, Sonny, you described the plot. Alyssa, you just spent like 8 minutes engaging in depth and earnestly with the themes of this movie. This is a movie that is almost entirely unintelligibly unfollowable. Like, yes, you can pull these things out of this, but this movie, there's no themes. There's no ideas. There's no story to speak of. It makes no sense at all. Again, yes, and to describe it clearly and cleanly for the audience is, I think, in some ways a disservice. This is a movie about a woman who starts we see a narration by Mary Shelley, and then another woman in 1930s Chicago played by her starts spouting words that you can't even understand or just babbling. Again, kind of like somebody who has serious mental illnesses, stands on the table, is murdered by the guys at the table, and then the rest of the movie, like after she is revived, is just her sort of pointing guns and kind of babbling nonsense words mixed with feminist Zen cones. That's it. And like to talk about this movie as something that like you can engage with on an intellectual or narrative or like as film, like this is just totally unintelligible garbage. This is a big swing, but it is a big swing at like it's like the batter walked out into the crowd
hitting people in the head with a baseball bat.
It's like, what are you doing? That's not baseball, and this isn't a movie. As long as we're inventing alternative versions, I do want to see Emerald Fennell's version. And this made me appreciate Wuthering Heights much, much more. And I kind of like that movie. I gave it a, thumbs up. Because as I said when we in that review, Emerald Fennell's Wuthering Heights is a kind of rare thing in that it is a female film director in sicko mode. And love it or hate it, the thing about that movie is that everything is perfectly coherent. Yeah, okay, it's not a direct adaptation of the novel, but it is every bizarre image, every cut, every scene, even if the movie's a little bit too long, that movie is totally, deeply, thematically, internally coherent. Every single choice in it serves a clear, discernible purpose that has layers, that is nice to go through. And even like the most bizarre stuff that you as a studio executive or somebody who is like concerned about the audience might say, that's normally not the kind of thing we feature in these sorts of movies. Like, it totally makes sense and holds up at every single level, while also being a big swing that is visually pretty arresting and kind of a weird, I don't know if I want to call it feminist, but certainly a weird and very, very female specific rethinking of a classic. And this is the opposite of that. At no point does anything work in this movie.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I mean, I also think that both of you are correct about the way that Christian Bale's character kind of takes over this movie, but it also really undercuts the horror of it, right? I mean, he steals this woman's body, invents a story for her, and just lies to her consistently about it over a long time. I think a movie that actually has aged pretty well in my mind in some ways is Don't Worry Darling, which again is like a much more interesting version of these questions about what happens, what is it like to be a man who is so sort of needs a woman to fill such a specific role in his life that he essentially steals her and turns her into a doll, right? But this movie ends with the bride coming to understand what Frank has done to her. And then you know, instead of seeing his murder immediately after that revelation as an opportunity for her own liberation, focuses on rescuing him and bringing him home and, you know, wanting him to be reanimated again. And it's...
But I mean, to be fair, the problem here is that he didn't kill her. Like, he did save her life, right? Like, he brought her back to life. Like, it is, I would say,
but
it
like,
is not,
is,
she...
Is re, like, is revitalization life? Is, like, a life where you are just sort of the empty vessel for someone else's story about you? Is that life? Right?
The movie doesn't have an answer to this question because it doesn't have an answer to any reason.
Well, it doesn't even frame the question, right? Yes.
Right. Well, no, that is the problem. Again, as I said in my review, this movie has no handle whatsoever on the questions it is asking, to the extent that I think you guys are right, that it doesn't even understand some of the questions that are being asked. But it does hit a lot. It hits all the beats. You got bad cops doing sexual assaults. That could not be like a more 2019 thing to really get agitated about. I don't know. I would defend it slightly against Peter's suggestion that there are no ideas. I think it has too many ideas in certain ways. And I really do just think, I really think that this is a movie where if you had just changed the framing device from Mary Shelley herself is in the head of this reanimated woman to just like, I'm Mary Shelley, I'm the narrator, here's what's going on. I think that solves at least like 20% of the problems here. I wouldn't necessarily make it a good movie, but it would at least like make it sensical.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, I struggle with this movie because I think all three of us thought that like The Lost Daughter was pretty good, right? This is Gyllenhaal's directorial debut. It's a movie, again, featuring, you know, in a smaller role in flashbacks, Jesse Buckley and Peter Sarsgaard. And it's a movie about female monstrosity in a way, but it's also, that is a movie about how the bar for female behavior to be considered monstrous is so low, right? I mean, you know, Olivia Colman's character, Jesse Buckley, is a younger woman, like does something bad in that she leaves her marriage, leaves her children in search of her ambition. But the movie is sort of interesting and interested in how that has left her sort of permanently on the margins in some ways and permanently sort of alienated from people around her. And that in a way is just like a much more interesting, simpler argument, right? That like, the barrier for a woman to be considered a monster is much lower than the barrier for a man to be considered a monster. Especially when a woman makes a sort of masculine coded decision, that's sort of a quick route to monstrosity. And I would have been really interested to see Gyllenhaal successfully continue to explore some of those questions, because I think they're good ones. But this movie is not that. It's a disaster.
Exit question. What do we make of Maggie Gyllenhaal casting her brother Jake as the sort of star, the object of Frank's affection, the screen idol who turns out to be kind of not cruel precisely, but callous when Frank makes his joy for him known? There's Freudian things happening here.
Especially because she gave this interview to the New York Times that made it sound like her casting him in this movie was like not quite ending an estrangement between the two of them, but like bringing them together. I do think it is an interesting submission of his stardom to her directorial will, because I think he has obviously had the more successful career, although I wouldn't quite define either of them as movie stars. And so I feel like maybe it has sort of a private meaning to the two of them that does not translate clearly to anything on the screen.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't read her explanation of this. It could just be, well, he's available during these 8 days that we need to shoot. And you know what? He's my brother. He's got to say yes.
He does basically have to say yes. I just assume it's
It could also just be that she has a that she sort of thought it was funny to have Christian Bale, who is legitimately like one of the top 10 male movie stars alive right now. Like Christian Bale being kind of sad and like looking up to her brother. Maybe she just thought that was funny, right?
That is funny.
You can do it because you're the director. Yeah, what are they going to do? They're not going to say no to you, obviously, based on anything that we on screen. Someone should have said no.
It is an interesting kind of meta commentary on the ways that certain kinds of stardom no longer exist in the movies, right? And like we've talked about this a little bit about how like there is less room for like the Gene Hackmans of the world to become like enormous stars, that you know, a certain like the song and dance man as massive star does not exist anymore. And you know, both Gyllenhaal and
But now they do action choreography instead.
Yes, well,
I'm kind of serious. Have you seen the videos of Keanu Reeves, 60 years old, in his blue jeans, just going through the choreography before they shoot? And it's just like, oh, you are a dancer who is just like beating people up with pistols, but you are fundamentally, you are a dancer, dude.
Yeah. But I do think it's as a brother and sister who never quite found their thing in Hollywood and still had pretty good careers. It is an interesting commentary on kinds of stardom that no longer exist.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Bride? Peter.
Thumbs down. This is maybe worse than Madam Web.
Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
Is it worse than Madam Web?
I haven't seen Madam
Web. Yeah, remember the episode we did on Madam Web was you and I explained it to her and we could barely finish our sentences because didn't believe us. Okay. She couldn't believe that anything we said about that movie was true. And you know what? We should have done that with this episode.
This
is my problem with the way you described this, Sonny. And I'm a little joking, but I'm actually a little bit not. That like it genuinely does a disservice to readers to try to clean this up to readers, to listeners, viewers.
Well, I did it with my review as well. So for readers for them as well. I'm trying to give everybody involved the benefit of the doubt. That's what I do. I'm a benefit of the doubt.
Charitable soul.
I'm a deeply charitable person, like Frankenstein himself. I don't want to give offense to anyone. I just want everyone to like me.
So what you're saying is that you're giving a contrarian thumbs up?
No, it's a bad movie. Thumbs down. But I'm stalling because I'm trying to think if it's worse than Madam Web. I would say this movie's better than Madam Web just because it is interesting. It's more interesting than Madam Web was. Madam Web, not interesting.
This is what we need to do. I need to watch Madam Web and then we can do a bonus tiebreaker episode on whether The Bride is worse than Madam Web.
We should have a Madam Web scale. Like, is this movie, where on the Madam Web, is this like plus two Madam Web or negative one Madam Web?
I'll watch Madam Web and we can do the inaugural Madam Web scale.
Okay. I think whatever the case is, we can all agree that this, you can't agree on the Madam Web part, but this and Madam Web are the two worst movies I have seen for this podcast.
Okay, good standard. Looking forward to figuring out whether that's true.
It's certainly up there. I would have to go back through the whole archive. I don't know. We saw Joker 2. That was pretty bad.
Yep. This is worse.
All right. That is it for this week's. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.